WHJLO 1690 AM Radio Montreal.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Hezbollah is taunting the Israelis and showing its capabilities and trying to keep everybody psychologically off balance in Israel, the citizenry, the government, the army. And this is going to go on for as long as the Israelis keep up their genocide in Gaza and the Americans keep supporting them and the world does nothing.
As Gaza ceasefire drags on, the talks around a Gaza ceasefire, Israel and Hezbollah engage in the heaviest cross-border attacks in months. The UN's calling for an immediate de-escalation. We'll get an update with Palestinian-American Rami Khoury. Then a federal judge has dealt a major blow to calls for justice in the police killing of Breonna Taylor, throwing out felony charges against two former Louisville police officers for their roles in Taylor's fatal shooting in her own home. We'll speak with family attorney Ben Crump. And we'll be joined by New York City Council member Yusuf Salam, one of the exonerated Central Park Five, who just addressed the Democratic National Convention last week in Chicago.
When they see us, America will finally say goodbye to that hateful man. We will say what I have said after seven long years of wrongful incarceration. Free at last. Free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for an immediate de-escalation after Israel and Hezbollah exchange heavy fire over the weekend. Early on Sunday morning, over 100 Israeli warplanes struck about 40 sites in Lebanon. Hezbollah responded by launching hundreds of drones and rockets at Israel. Three deaths were reported in Lebanon, one in Israel. Israel described its attacks as preemptive, saying the raid was conducted to blunt an imminent attack by Hezbollah. But Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah rejected that claim.
What happened was an aggression, not a preemptive action. And if we were to assume this was a preemptive action, it left no impact whatsoever on our military operations today, neither on its missiles, nor on its drones, nor on its fighters.
We'll have more on this story after headlines. Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of arbitrarily detaining and torturing Palestinian healthcare workers. Eight doctors, nurses, and paramedics recently held in Israeli prisons have described being blindfolded, beaten, held in forced stress positions, and handcuffed for extended periods of time. They also reported torture, including rape and sexual abuse by Israeli forces. Over the weekend, Israel bombed another school in Gaza, sheltering displaced Palestinians. Meanwhile, on Saturday, an Israeli strike on a home in Khan Yunis killed 11 members of the same family, including two children. This comes as Israeli forces have withdrawn from the Hamad City portion of Khan Yunis, leaving the neighborhood largely destroyed. Rescue workers recovered 16 bodies from the rubble. Residents say they have no safe place to go.
We're a safe area. There is no safety. Where is safety? We flee every day. We get displaced every day under the rockets, under the bombing. I am alone with my little children. I flee with them every day from a place to another. I don't know where to go. They tell you about safe areas. Where is safety? Make me feel safe. Make the little child feel safe. We are tired people. It's enough. Have mercy.
Hostage talks were held in Cairo, Egypt, over the weekend, But a deal has not been reached. Egyptian officials said neither Hamas nor Israel agreed to a number of compromises put forward by a mediator. Hamas has said any deal must include a permanent ceasefire and a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. At least three people died overnight in Ukraine as Russia launched a barrage of drone and missile strikes targeting critical infrastructure, including power and water supplies across Ukraine. The attacks come a day after five Russian civilians were killed in a Ukrainian strike on the Russian city of Belgorod. Meanwhile, in the Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk, a safety advisor working for the Reuters news agency was killed and four Reuters journalists were injured in a Russian strike on their hotel on Saturday. Ryan Evans was a 38-year-old British citizen. In a statement, Reuters said, quote, "Ryan has helped so many of our journalists cover events around the world. We will miss him terribly," unquote. The injured journalists are reportedly from Ukraine, the United States, Latvia, and Germany. Two of them were hospitalized. Meanwhile, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi met with President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv on Friday. Modi called for peace talks to end the war.
No conflict can be resolved on the battlefield. The road to resolution can only be found through dialogue and diplomacy, and we should move in that direction without wasting any time. Both sides should sit together to find ways to end this crisis.
In news from Iraq, two journalists were killed on Friday in a Turkish drone strike. The journalists, Gulistan Tara of Turkey and Hira Bahadin of Iraq, worked for the Kurdish outlet Stark TV. A third journalist was seriously wounded. Another journalist working for a Kurdish outlet was killed last month. Reporters Without Borders says Iraqi Kurdistan is becoming one of the most dangerous areas in the world for reporters. In U.S. election news, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has suspended, though not ended, his independent presidential campaign and endorsed Donald Trump. The two campaigned together on Friday in Arizona. Kennedy's brothers and sisters have publicly criticized his decision. In a statement, they said, quote, "Our brother Bobby's decision to endorse Trump today is a betrayal of the values that our father and our family hold most dear. It is a sad ending to a sad story," they said. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is the son of Robert F. Kennedy, a nephew of President John F. Kennedy, both of whom were assassinated in the 1960s. On Friday, Donald Trump vowed, if elected, to launch a commission on presidential assassinations and attempts.
"And they will also conduct a rigorous review of the attack last month. But I tell you, I have never had more people ask me, 'Please, sir, release the documents on the Kennedy assassination.' And we're going to do that."
In other election news, Kamala Harris's campaign has reported she set a new record by raising $540 million over the past month since President Biden suspended his reelection bid. Harris and her running mate Tim Walz will launch a Georgia bus tour on Wednesday. Donald Trump's golf resort in Bedminster, New Jersey, is hosting a January 6 awards gala next week when organizers plan to honor 20 defendants arrested for taking part in the deadly January 6 insurrection. Donald Trump is listed as an invited speaker to the gala. Meanwhile, a Maryland man who threw a smoke bomb at police on January 6 has been convicted on a number of charges, including civil disorder and assaulting police. Justin Lee, who became a police officer after the insurrection, will be sentenced on November 6. The U.S. Department of Justice in eight states have sued the property management software company RealPage, accusing the firm of helping landlords collude to drive up the cost of rent. The firm collects rental information from competing corporate landlords and then uses algorithms to set rents. Attorney General Merrick Garland accused the firm of violating the Sherman Antitrust Act.
"When the Sherman Act was passed, an anti-competitive scheme might have looked like robber barons shaking hands at a secret meeting. Today, it looks like landlords using mathematical algorithms to align their rents."
In Kentucky, A federal judge has thrown out felony charges against two former Louisville police officers connected with the fatal police shooting of Breonna Taylor in her own home over 4 years ago. The two officers had been accused of falsifying a warrant that led to the fatal police raid on Taylor's apartment. The officers, Joshua Janes and Kyle Meany, were not at the scene of the shooting in March 2020. We'll have more on this later in the broadcast. We'll be speaking with Taylor family attorney Ben Crump. In Tennessee, a second former Memphis police officer has pleaded guilty in the police killing of Tyre Nichols, a 29-year-old black father who died after a brutal police beating. The former officer, Emmett Martin, pleaded guilty to federal civil rights violations and could face up to 40 years in prison. In Florida, a sheriff's deputy has been charged with manslaughter in connection with the killing of Roger Fortson, a 23-year-old black Air Force member who was shot to death in his own home. According to the Associated Press, former Okaloosa County Deputy Eddie Duran is just the fourth Florida police officer in the past 35 years to be charged for an on-duty killing. French authorities have detained the founder and CEO of the popular news and messaging service Telegram. Pavel Durov was detained at a Paris airport on an arrest warrant related to allegations that Telegram has been used for illegal activity. Durov is a dual French-Russian citizen. Telegram posted a message online saying, quote, "It's absurd to claim that a platform or its owner are responsible for abuse of that platform. Almost a billion users globally use Telegram as means of communication and as a source of vital information," unquote. The app has a history of refusing to cooperate with law enforcement. In Burkina Faso, a militant group with links to al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility for an attack that killed up to 200 people and injured 140. According to the Norwegian Refugee Council, attacks in Burkina Faso this year have killed more than 8,400 people. At least 13 migrants are dead after their boat sank off the coast of Yemen. Authorities are searching for over a dozen others who've been missing since last week, according to the International Organization for Migration, the IOM. The boat had departed from Djibouti in East Africa, carrying 25 Ethiopian and 2 Yemeni migrants. Annually, tens of thousands of migrants depart from the Horn of Africa, fleeing conflict, extreme poverty, and the impacts of the climate crisis, setting off on a dangerous journey across the Red Sea, many with the hope of reaching wealthier nations and the Gulf. In Norway, climate activists with the group Extinction Rebellion blocked an oil terminal at a major gas processing plant Saturday.
Now we are outside the Karstø oil terminal. We have just begun a blockade of one of Norway's largest processing plants for gas in the North Sea. So we demand a plan for a phasing out of oil and gas production in Norway, because oil and gas are killing the planet and several billion people are in danger of losing their lives if we cannot manage to remain under the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming.
Here in New York, dozens of feminist climate activists were arrested outside the Manhattan home of city CEO Jane Fraser. The action was part of Summer of Heat, a season-long series of civil disobedience targeting the funders of the climate crisis. And the Biden administration has been dealt a setback in its efforts to use the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to fight environmental injustice in Louisiana. On Friday, a federal court ruled the Environmental Protection Agency is barred from using the federal civil rights law to prevent Louisiana from issuing permits to new fossil fuel facilities in an area known as Cancer Alley, a predominantly black community. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for an immediate de-escalation after Israel and Hezbollah exchanged heavy fire over the weekend. Early Sunday morning, over 100 Israeli warplanes struck about 40 sites in Lebanon. Hezbollah responded by launching hundreds of drones and rockets at Israel. 3 deaths were reported in Lebanon, 1 in Israel. Israel described its attacks as preemptive, saying the raid was conducted to blunt an imminent attack by Hezbollah. But Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah rejected the claim.
What happened was an aggression, not a preemptive action. And if we were to assume this was a preemptive action, it left no impact whatsoever on our military operations today, neither on its missiles, nor on its drones, nor on its fighters.
Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, also spoke about the Gaza ceasefire negotiations in Cairo, Egypt.
Our operation today, in any case, may be very useful for the negotiations, for the Palestinian side or the Arab side that is negotiating alongside the Palestinian team. And its message is clear to the enemy and to those behind the enemy, to the Americans, that any hopes of shutting down the supporting fronts, whether in Lebanon, in Yemen, or in Iraq, these fronts are actually open. These hopes are dashed.
Meanwhile, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said Israel's military campaign against Hezbollah will continue.
What happened today is not the end of the story. Hezbollah tried to attack the state of Israel with rockets and drones early in the morning. We instructed the Israeli army to carry out a powerful preemptive strike to remove the threat. The Israeli army destroyed thousands of short-range rockets. All of them were intended to harm our citizens and our forces in the Galilee. In addition, the Israeli army intercepted all the UAVs that Hezbollah launched at a strategic target in the center of the country.
An American journalist, senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. Rami, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about this escalation of violence. I mean, we haven't seen anything like this on the northern border between Israel and Lebanon in many months.
It's an escalation of aggression by Israel and resistance by Hezbollah. And the mutual attacks back and forth have been going on for probably the last 16, 18 years since the 2006 war between them. But this is significant for several reasons. First, it's a much higher level of attack in the number of fighter jets from the Israeli sides and sites attacked, and the number of rockets and drones sent by Hezbollah. Both sides are claiming things that we can't verify, so we just have to wait a little bit, a couple of days more, for the actual factual evidence to come out. But what's significant from the Hezbollah side is that they used Katyusha rockets mostly, which are kind of old-fashioned, limited capability rockets, not very good in terms of hitting, being aimed, etc. Then they used some drones, and their focus was to detract the defense system in Israel, the air defense system, with the rockets, and then get the drones in to attack some military sites. They're clearly targeting military sites, the Israelis say everything is fine. The Hezbollah says they hit some of their targets, but they're assessing the situation now. But the more sophisticated weapons that Hezbollah has, with much better guidance systems, much more accurate, and can evade the Israeli defense systems, haven't been used yet. So this is a sign from Hezbollah that they're going through attack to avenge the killing of their commander in Beirut about a month ago. And they are going to do it with increasingly sophisticated weapon system down the road. Their aim is to do psychological warfare as well as actual damage. They want the whole country to remain on edge. They want the army to be preoccupied in the north. They want the 70,000, 80,000 civilians who are evacuated from North Israel to remain evacuated and annoyed and angry. Disruption to businesses, to tourism, to all kinds of investments, to keep the military guessing what's gonna come next. So this is an escalation of a pattern that's been really the norm for many, many years. And both sides, remarkably, but expectedly, said earlier today that they have finished this phase, and therefore they're not going to continue large-scale attacks today or tomorrow. It seems that they've done what they did. And this is the pattern, that one side does something, the other side does something of equal magnitude. And it's going to go on until two things happen. The Israelis get out of Gaza, and the Palestinians can rebuild their lives there. And second of all, signs of action or movement towards resolving the overall Palestinian-Israeli and Arab-Israeli conflict, some signs of that materialize. Because until then, this is going to continue. There will continue to be this antagonism by the Hezbollah and Lebanese and Syrians and Palestinians and others and Yemenis towards Israel for what it's done in Palestine. And this has to be resolved politically. It can't be resolved militarily.
This is Israeli Army spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari speaking Sunday.
We look around the state of Israel all the time, also at Yemen, also at Iran. I remind you that Hezbollah is an extension of the Iranians. They are financed, armed, targeted by the Iranians, and I am convinced that this widespread shooting is also directed by Iran, also under Iranian responsibility, and we will attack and remove threats wherever necessary.
If you can respond, Rami Khoury.
This is a typical Israeli Zionist propaganda message that has been going on for years and years. They will always, and with the U.S. close behind them, following their lead, they'll always find some threat in the Middle East. Before, it used to be Saddam Hussein, it was Qaeda, it was the Russians, it was the PLO. Now it's Iran is behind everything bad. And they will focus a lot of attention on addressing that issue, trying to evade the central reality that the Palestine-Israel conflict, the conflict between Zionism and Arabism in Palestine, which has been going on for 100 years, that's the real core of the problem. And so these are evasive tactics, diversionary tactics. Iran is a very close ally of Hezbollah. They're deeply involved in increasing its technical and military capabilities, as they are with Hamas and the Ansarullah and Yemen, the Houthis. But to say that Iran directs them and tells them what to do, I believe is a bit of a stretch. And so it's like the relationship between Israel and the United States. They're very close in armaments and strategy, and the U.S. now is actively, almost enthusiastically, supporting the Israeli genocide in Gaza. But Israel does what it feels it needs to do, and the U.S. doesn't seem to be able or willing to stop it. And I think we have a similar relationship between Hezbollah and Iran. They're very close, but Iran doesn't command direct Hezbollah and telling it what to do.
If you can talk about what's happening right now, this whole the Gaza ceasefire negotiations, Hamas sent representatives to Cairo, Israel had their delegation, Egypt and Qatar are involved, but it looks like they broke down once again, though they say they're continuing.
Well, they'd reached an agreement in early July when Biden announced his so-called, plan for a ceasefire, and Hamas accepted it. Biden said this came from the Israelis, and then when Hamas accepted it, the Israelis, Netanyahu, came back and added more conditions, and this has been the pattern ever since. And whenever Hamas accepts it, they add more conditions, suggesting that Netanyahu doesn't really want a ceasefire. He wants to just keep negotiating. And I think it's pretty clear now that the ceasefire negotiations today are the equivalent of the so-called peace process in the bigger Arab-Israeli conflict over the last 40 years, which also was under U.S. Management or direction. And the ceasefire talks seem to be, in the eyes of most analysts and observers in the Middle East, seem to be a mechanism just to delay anything serious from happening, to allow Israel to continue with its genocidal killing of, the figures, the official figures are over 40,000. Most people say it's closer to 150,000 dead, but we'll find that out in the future. So the ceasefire talks are a fictitious political dynamic. And the reason they're fictitious is because the United States is trying to be the main driver of the peace process to the point where Biden announced an agreement back in early July. But the U.S. is also the main funder, arms supplier, and political cover provider, diplomatic protector of Israel in the U.N. and other places. You can't have the one party that is the major force for letting the genocide happen, technically and politically, and at the same time claim to be a mediator that's trying to mediate between Israel and Hamas. This is the kind of fiction and the fantasy that comes out of the State Department and the White House, and most of the world just watches this on TV thinking, oh, something might happen. The important point is the Hamas, and you see it in Hezbollah, is that they have taken a much harder position. They say, we accepted the ceasefire that Biden provided that came from Israel. What more do you want from us? We are ready to stop the fighting, exchange prisoners and hostages, etc., etc. But they have certain hardcore demands. And what's obvious now is that both Hezbollah and Hamas refuse to play the game that all the Arab governments and Fatah under Arafat and now under Abu Mazen, the Palestinian leadership, played for so many years, which is to make concession after concession after concession, rely on Western or other international intervention, and then expect something to happen. We've realized, everybody in the Arab region has realized, that this is not a serious process. This is the latest manifestation of a colonial process managed by white, northern, racist, militant groups, countries. It used to be England, now it's the United States, that keeps playing games with the people of the region for the benefits of either the Western powers or today for Israel. So the ceasefire talks should not be taken very seriously as an effort to actually bring about a ceasefire. They are better seen as an indication of the skewed relationship between Western imperial powers and Israel, which is their closest manifestation in the region, settler colonial power, relations between them and between the Palestinians, who are standing steady. Hamas is holding its ground and saying, look, we're prepared to make peace. We're prepared to coexist with the current Israeli state, as a Jewish majority state. They've made these offers many times, but they're refusing to make more concessions is an important indicator of where they are, and this is something that the Western Israeli and Western imperial powers don't know how to handle. They're not used to steadfast Arab parties. They're used to compliant Arabs. Who, you know, roll over and say, yes, sir, yes, sir. And this isn't happening anymore. So this is an important moment. You know, it's a generational change in leaderships in the Arab country. And this is why the majority of ordinary people in the Arab world stand by Hamas and the Palestinians. They might not support the actual actions that it had used, whether either on October 7 or previously in terms of terror attacks inside Israel, you know, attacking buses and pizza parlors and stuff, but they support its basic political stand that we have rights, we are prepared to achieve those rights through a peaceful negotiation, we are not prepared to play cartoon games with people like Anthony Blinken and Dennis Ross before him and people who are not serious about the real resolution that is required to address the real core of the problem, which is the conflict between Israel and Zionism on the one hand and Arab, Palestinian Arabism on the other. There is a resolution to that conflict, a peaceful resolution that can be done, just like there is a resolution in Gaza, but the Israelis don't want to do it.
Rami Khoury, I want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. When we come back, a federal judge has dealt a major blow to calls for justice in the police killing of Breonna Taylor, throwing out felony charges against two former Louisville police officers for their roles in her fatal shooting in her own home. We'll speak with the family attorney, Ben Crump, as well as the Tyre Nichols case and more. Stay with us. الطغيان يزهر عصيان لو رح اموت ميت مرة رح اعود ميت مرة مصقول الحسام اغطش الضجيجا يشبهني نلتحم ببعض ونستعصي by Mashru Leila. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the police killing of Breonna Taylor in Kentucky, where a federal judge has dealt a major blow to calls for justice after throwing out felony charges against two former Louisville police officers for their roles in her fatal shooting in her own home over 4 years ago. Officers Joshua Janes and Kyle Meany, who are white, were charged in 2022 with falsifying a warrant that led to the police raid on Taylor's apartment in March 2020. The two officers were not present during the fatal shooting. The federal judge instead has ruled that Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, is legally responsible for her death after he fired his gun, thinking that the men were intruders in the home, when seven plainclothes police officers serving a no-knock warrant broke down the door, barged in just after midnight on March 13, 2020. 26-year-old Breonna Taylor was an emergency medical technician, an aspiring nurse. She was asleep when she was shot dead. In 2022, the Justice Department filed civil rights charges against four officers involved in Taylor's death. Kelly Goodlett was the only one to plead guilty in 2022, admitting she had helped a fellow officer lie to convince a judge to sign off on the no-knock warrant, falsely claiming they had evidence of drug dealings taking place in Taylor's home. No drugs were ever found. Meanwhile, former Louisville officer Brett Hankison faces a third trial in October. He was acquitted in 2022 of three state counts of wanton endangerment for shooting into Breonna Taylor's neighbor's apartment during the raid. And last year, a jury was deadlocked over whether to convict him on use of excessive force in violating Taylor's rights, her partner's, and her neighbor's. The two officers who actually fatally shot Taylor, Jonathan Mattingly and Miles Cosgrove, have never been charged. Breonna Taylor's death in a hail of police gunfire in 2020, which came just 2 months before the police murder of George Floyd in Minnesota, sparked protests across the country and world. For more, we're joined by Ben Crump, civil rights attorney. Ben, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain what this judge's ruling means?
That it continues the systematic pattern of disrespect to Black women, and the fact that there is little to no justice when Black women are unjustly killed by those who are supposed to protect and serve them. The family is devastated. Us social justice, civil rights attorneys are just dumbfounded by this ruling. You have officers who lie on a probable cause affidavit to get a no-knock warrant to bust into a woman's apartment. That Black woman, Breonna Taylor, is killed as a result of your unnecessary, unjustifiable, unconstitutional affront to the Fourth Amendment against unlawful search and seizure. And yet the judge says, well, there's nothing they did to cause her death, but yet we want to blame her boyfriend, a black man named Kenny Walker, who is legally in the apartment, who has a lawful right to be a registered gun owner, who tries to defend his home, his woman, himself. And that is what you're going to say is the cause of her death, because they were trying to defend themselves against people they thought were burglarizing their home. It flies in the face of justice and all common sense.
I mean, Kenny was very clear in saying he did not understand that these men were police officers, that they didn't identify himself. They were breaking down his door.
Yeah, you know, Amy, it's the intellectual justification of discrimination. These officers knew that they were lying before on the probable cause affidavit, and then as Officer Gottlieb has pled and testified, they were trying to conspire and lie in the aftermath of killing Breonna Taylor. Now, everybody else in America sees that. This federal judge apparently is doing what the United States government has done, whether it's Pamela Turner's case, who a black woman killed in Houston, Texas. We're fighting Sonya Massey now in Illinois. It's this Sandra Bland. It's this epidemic of black women being killed by police and police getting away with murder. And we have to scream at the top of our lungs to continue to say their name and not let them get away with this. The Justice Department is going to appeal this matter. And what we're going to continue to do is to rally for justice both in the courtrooms and outside the courtrooms for these black women like Breonna Taylor, like Pamela Turner, like Atiana Jefferson, like Sonya Massey. I mean, how many more?
Ben Crump, I also wanted to ask you about the news that a second former Memphis police officer has pleaded guilty in the police killing of Tyre Nichols, the 29-year-old black father who died after a brutal police beating. The former officer, Emmett Martin, pleaded guilty to federal civil rights violations and could face up to 40 years in prison. Go back to the story of Tyre Nichols. Tell us what happened and what this means.
Well, obviously, Tyre Nichols was one of the worst police videos of brutality that we've ever witnessed. Tyre Nichols was about two blocks from his home. He didn't break any laws, but there was a Scorpion unit, this special tactic unit at the Memphis Police Department that was allowed to harass and violate the constitutional rights of black people in a certain section of Memphis, Tennessee, under the guise that they were deterring crime. And so it was a pattern and practice that they could just unjustly use excessive force to intimidate black citizens in that part of the city. And they said they wanted to do it because they wanted to lower the crime. And as I and Reverend Al Sharpton said, well, if you're not doing this in the white part of town, how do you prevent crime there? Well, that's the same tactics you should employ in the black side of town. And this violent, brutal beating of Tyre Nichols by these five officers. I mean, he was barely conscious, and they kept holding him up, and they'd punch him some more like he was a rag doll, like he was a human piñata. I mean, they were kicking him, hitting him with batons, and they literally beat him to death. And if it was not for the camera on the night pole, they would have probably gotten away with it. But that camera showed us everything, Amy. And our stomachs were literally in knots watching them beat a human being to death. And at this point, all of them have been charged both in the state and federal levels for their crimes that caused the death of Tyre Nichols. The second officer has pled guilty and can face up to 40 years in prison in the federal case.
Ben Crump, I mean, it's horrifying that I have one case after another to ask you about. But I want to ask you about this third case that you're working on in Florida. A sheriff's deputy has been charged with manslaughter in connection with the killing of 23-year-old Air Force member Roger Fortson, who was shot to death also in his own home. Police body camera footage from the May 3rd killing shows Roger Fortson answering the door of his own apartment and immediately being fatally shot by an Okaloosa County officer who was responding to a domestic disturbance report that turned out to be false. The officer shot Fortman almost immediately as he opened the door. This is a clip of the horrifying video.
Sheriff's office, open the door. Step out. Drop the gun! Drop the gun!
He's over there.
Drop the gun!
I don't have it.
312, shots fired. Suspect down. Do not move! 312, get EMS my location.
On Thursday, former Okaloosa County Deputy Eddie Duran was charged with manslaughter with a firearm in connection with the fatal shooting of senior airman Roger Fortson, which is first-degree felony punishable by up to 30 years in prison, Ben.
Yeah, Amy, it's still heartbreaking that this 23-year-old senior airman, this American hero who fought to protect the constitutional rights, was killed in such an unjustified manner when he simply opened his door. It was, we believe, the apartment complex getting it wrong, but then this officer getting it wrong because the officer did not give Roger any time to comply with his orders. Roger, who was a law-abiding registered gun owner, again, like Kenny Walker Brown is born, man, when black men have guns, they're not seen as law-abiding citizens. They're seen as criminals that you must take down for whatever reason by law enforcement. But he had his gun in a down position. The officer immediately told him to step back. Roger stepped back. Roger was following all the instructions of this officer who shot him multiple times, and even while he was on the ground dying, Amy, he was still trying to follow the instructions and the orders of this officer. And so it was appropriate that this officer was charged with manslaughter for use of a firearm. But it is so very rare in the state of Florida that this happens. It's only been four officers in the last 35 years that have been charged for killing citizens. All of them happen to be African-American citizens that were killed in these four charges, and there's only been one conviction in 35 years. And so we have to stay vigilant that Roger Fortson gets justice.
I want to thank you very much, Ben, for joining us. Ben Crump is a civil rights attorney. He's the attorney for the families of Fortson, Roger Fortson, and Tyree Nichols, and Breonna Taylor. Next up, we'll be joined by New York City Councilmember Yusuf Salam, one of the exonerated Central Park Five, who just addressed the Democratic National Convention last week in Chicago. Back in 30 seconds.
Thank you.
Sorrow for Tomorrow by the Sacred Souls. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with a New York City council member who just spoke in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention. He's Yusuf Salam, one of the teenagers from Harlem more than 35 years ago, four African-American, one Latino, who in 1988 were wrongfully accused and convicted of raping and nearly killing a 28-year-old white investment banker who was out for a jog in Central Park. In the sensational trial that followed, the young men became known as the Central Park Five. Donald Trump spent $85,000 on full-page ads in four newspapers with the headline, "Bring back the death penalty, bring back our police." The ad read in part, quote, "Mayor Koch has stated that hate and rancor should be removed from our hearts. I do not think so. I want to hate these muggers and murderers," the ad said. During the trial, the teens maintained their innocence, but in 1990, they were convicted. Antron McRae, Kevin Richardson, Yusuf Salam, and Raymond Santana served between 6 and 7 years in prison. Corey Wise, the only teenager tried as an adult, served more than 13 years. Their story was captured in the four-part Netflix series written and directed by Ava DuVernay called When They See Us. Well, on Thursday, the night that Kamala Harris spoke, before that, four members of the exonerated Central Park Five were introduced by Reverend Al Sharpton as they appeared on the stage at the DNC. Corey Wise, Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, and now New York City Council Member Yusuf Salam. Two of them spoke, Yusuf Salam, but first, Corey Wise.
We won't go back.
Good evening, people. My name is Corey Wise. 35 years ago, my friends and I were in prison for a crime we did not commit. Our youth was stolen from us. Every day as we walked into courtroom, people screamed at us, threatened us because of Donald Trump. He spent $85,000 on a full-page ad in the New York Times calling for our execution. We were innocent kids, but we served a total of 41 years in prison. Reverend Al Sharpton stood with us. Now, I'm proud to stand with him today. Vice President Kamala Harris has also worked to make things fairer. I know she will do the same as president. Now approve that message.
I love these guys. These are my brothers. These are my brothers. Yes, indeed. America. I am Yusuf Salam. A New York City councilman representing my hometown of Harlem. That's right. Representing my hometown of Harlem, USA. And listen, as my friend Corey Wise just said, 45 wanted us unalive. He wanted us dead. Today we are exonerated. Because the actual perpetrator confessed, and DNA proved it. That guy says he still stands by the original guilty verdict. He dismisses the scientific evidence rather than admit he was wrong. He has never changed, and he never will. That man thinks that hate is the animating force in America. It is not. We have the constitutional right to vote. In fact, it is a human right. So let us use it. I want you to walk with us. I want you to march with us. I want you to vote with us. And together, and let me tell you, this is going to be so beautiful. And together, on November 5th, we will usher in Kamala Harris and Tim Walz into the White House. So I want to do this. When I say one day, I want you to say, see us. When they
see us.
When they
see us.
When they see us, America will finally say goodbye to that hateful man. We will say what I have said after 7 long years on wrongful incarceration. Free at last. Free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America.
Two of the members of the exonerated Central Park Five on stage at the Democratic National Convention. That was New York City Council member Yusuf Salam, and before him, Corey Wise. Donald Trump wanted them dead. This comes as The Intercept's Liliana Segura reports the Democratic Party's platform this year no longer includes ending capital punishment, the death penalty, a goal enshrined in the party's platform for years. For more, we are joined by Yusuf Salam, representing Harlem. Yusuf, welcome back to Democracy Now! As you come off of the Democratic National Convention, your thoughts on what's happening today? It was very significant that the four of you were there. You have won a, $50 million settlement from New York City. You were exonerated. What was Donald Trump's response to your exoneration, given he'd taken out this full-page ad calling for your death?
My gosh, you know, well, first of all, thank you for having me. It is always a pleasure to be in conversation with you. Donald Trump has always stood by his original idea that we had to be guilty of something. As a matter of fact, I remember him saying just those very words. They had to be guilty of something. The reality was that we were guilty of the color of our skin. They had judged us by how we looked and not the content of our character. Right now, our country is in a very pivotal moment where the whole world is feeling the vibrations. And I think that is really a beautiful thing because we get the opportunity to really understand how democracy is on the ballot right now. That if Donald Trump wins, he's going to turn this into a dictatorship. He is going to turn us back to a state where we were considered chattel slavery. But if Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are in the White House, we get the opportunity to plan in safety. We get the opportunity to build a future that is brighter, more successful, that is inclusive, that allows for, I believe, the United States of America to be the real reality as opposed to where we are right now, divided and ununited.
The story of the Central Park Five is just astonishing, and I had a direct connection to it, aside from reporting on it. But Matthias Reis, the man who confessed and whose DNA matched after you all were in prison for so many years, the last woman he raped in my building. She ran out of the building screaming. The doorman jumped on him, and that's how he was caught. But this is the this is the price of racism, because after you all were arrested, Matthias went on to beat and rape five women murdering one of them, Lourdes Gonzalez, a pregnant mother of three. And it was only him coming forward, right, to one of you that led to you all being exonerated. He admitted his crime. His MO was the same all through the north of Central Park. But they never, for months, said there is this, when you are all jailed at this point, there is this killer, yeah. There is this rapist on the loose with the same MO, what they did to Patricia Maley, the stoning and rape of her.
That's right. You know, that's the collateral effect of getting it wrong. We want to be a country, I believe, that believes that the justice system works and works well. But the problem is that we became what I call the modern day Scottsboro boys. Donald Trump was allowed to take out those full page ads in New York City's newspapers in 1989, 2 weeks after we were accused, and essentially calling for the death penalty to be reinstated in our case. They published our names, phone numbers, and addresses. They were so angry at us, believing that we were capable of something as such, that they wanted to exact justice by any means necessary. The collateral effect of that was that the real perpetrator was left to commit more crime. That's what happens often when they get it wrong. The real person is out there committing more crime. Our families, our supporters, our loved ones said, you have the wrong individual. And guess what happened? They said, no, we think we have the right one. Allowing for the real criminal to continue to hurt, to maim, and also kill his victims. This was a travesty of justice. This is why we need change. This is why we need reform. We need to be able to make sure, in fact, that the justice system works. And we don't want people who are in prison to be in prison for crimes they didn't commit. We don't want people to be murdered for crimes they didn't commit. Like right now, we have the capital punishment throughout the nation that is still exacting souls and sending them to early graves. When the truth of the matter is that when we look at DNA evidence, many of these individuals are actually innocent. I'm thinking about Troy Davis. I'm thinking about countless others. We were out here fighting for them. Yes.
So, Yusuf, the Democratic National Committee has removed the abolishing the death penalty from the platform. In 2016, the platform read, "We'll abolish the death penalty, which has proven to be a cruel and unusual form of punishment. It has no place in the United States of America." Very quickly, your thoughts on that removal of the death penalty abolition?
I think that we may be able to push forward to get that reinstated. And I'm saying that it's a travesty to send people to prison for crime. I mean, to send people to jail for jail and also their death for crimes they didn't commit.
And
when I look at what happened to us, I can't help but think, you know, Corey Wise says it all the time. He says it really the best. He says, had Matias Reyes not come forward, I would have been living a 15 to life jail sentence. He would have still been in prison. They would have never let him go. That's how much they wanted us. They wanted this thing to be that. Yes.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds. You're in the car now driving. I can't even believe we're talking to you as you sit in the passenger seat. But you're a New York City Council member. You were elected to the New York City Council. And Donald Trump has become a felon, was convicted of well over a dozen felonies. Your thoughts?
You know, here's a person who, if he was black, he would not be able to run for public office. If he looked like me, he wouldn't even be able to vote. But here he is in the highest office of the land, telling people that he is going to allow for immunity for the things that he has done. Really, this is the erasure of what we see as the American justice system. Those things that actually work. We need those things. We need those things to be and to stay a part of the system. We do not need people to run over the justice system and create new ideas and imaginations of what is unfortunate and what is criminal.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Again, President Trump convicted of 34 felonies. That does it for our show. Yusuf Salam, now a New York City Council member. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
At Cinema Public, we offer a theatrical program made up of local films and international new releases, classics and little-known nuggets, as well as short films and family screenings. Our tickets are among the cheapest in Montreal, $10 for a regular entry or $8 for students, children, and seniors. We also offer 6-ticket movie cards for even more savings. Come see us at Casa d'Italia, just across from Jontolo Metro, and visit cinemapublic.ca to discover our programming. Le Cinéma Public for a lively cinema.
If you enjoy genres like slowcore, post-hardcore, noise rock, math rock, shoegaze, or anything like that, tune into Past Tense 9 p.m. Thursdays on CJLO. It also airs 9 p.m. Mondays on luradio.ca and 9 p.m. Wednesdays on CFRC.ca.